Hello and welcome to the 1913 Lockout podcast series. I'm your host, Moira Murphy. In this series, we'll be looking at the upcoming centenary of the 1913 Lockout and ask, why is it important to commemorate this event? What lessons for worker struggle in Ireland can we learn 100 years on? As we enter into a decade of commemoration, the ability to shape our collective history in order to understand the present situation will be vital. On this week's show, we'll be examining the decades leading up to the lockout and the conditions that people in Dublin had to live and work in on a daily basis. We'll be talking to historian Conor Costick and looking at two major figures of the lockout, Jim Larkin of the ITGWU and businessman William Martin Murphy. But first...
Ireland in the run-up to the 1913 lockout was shaped by two seismic political events in the 19th century. The first was the Act of Union in 1800, which dissolved Grattan's Parliament. At the time of its dissolution, Dublin was the second city of the largest empire on earth, acting as a seat of political power as well as a financial centre. Within 60 years of the Act, it was only the fifth largest city in the UK, and second in population and significance on the island of Belfast. The second event was the Great Potato Famine of the 1840s. The population of the island had peaked at little over 8 million shortly before the famine, but through death and emigration it almost halved by the start of the 20th century. Dublin saw an influx of landless poor which swelled the city's slums. Dublin's population in 1913 was just over 400,000, with three quarters living in the city itself and the rest in the more affluent suburbs. It was the poorest city in the UK and urban conditions were dreadful. Tens of thousands lived in single room tenements. Disease and malnutrition were widespread, and the city had the highest infant mortality rate in Europe. Dublin's economy was similarly dire, with a weak manufacturing base that employed only 20% of the workforce. There was an abundance of unskilled labour. By the early 20th century, a third of the city's workforce were either general labourers or domestic servants. Jobs were precarious, with a high turnover meaning little job security for workers. And it was the paying conditions of these unskilled labourers which was to be the focus of Jim Larkin's union organising. Politics in early 20th century Ireland was dominated by the national question. The more radical republican movement had fallen away in influence in the 19th century after the failure of the uprising of 1798. Daniel O'Connell rose to become the most significant political figure in the island in the early 1800s. His campaign for Catholic emancipation succeeded, but an attempt to repeal the Act of Union itself failed. Following this, the Home Rule movement developed in the mid to late 1800s. First with Isaac Butt's Home Government Association and League, and then Charles Stewart Parnell's National League. Parnell came close to achieving Home Rule in 1886, when British Prime Minister William Gladstone proposed a Home Rule bill that fell short by 30 votes. Parnell's involvement with a separated woman, Kitty O'Shea, was then to become the focus of national political attention, and when it was stoked by political opponents to create a moral panic which split the movement into pro and anti-Parnellite factions. These wings remained bitterly separated for a decade, only reforming in 1900 under John Redmond. Syndicalism arrived in Ireland with Larkin in the early 20th century. It was most prominently on display in the 1907 Belfast dock strike, where more than 3,000 workers faced a lockout of a similar kind, if a smaller size, to that which was to occur in Dublin 6 years later. Despite its historical importance as a struggle that united Catholic and Protestant workers, the dock strike failed in its aims. Larkin came into a dispute with the union leadership for his radical tactics and the large amount of money spent on strike pay, and was ultimately let go. But, as we will discuss in this show, that was very much not the end of James Larkin. I'm here with Dr. Conor Costick, who is a historian and writer researching medieval European history. Conor is the author of Revolution in Ireland, Popular Militancy 1917 to 1923, a book we highly recommend. Conor, we'll start with a backdrop. Can you tell us a bit about early 20th century Dublin?
Dublin is a very contradictory city in early 20th century, a contradiction which is expressed pithily and artistically by Joyce when he talked about big stones amongst the rubble. So you have these fantastic monumental buildings from the 18th century, and you've got horrible slums that have grown up around them. And that sort of reflects economic trends. The island is recovering from the famine, but in a very particular way. It's becoming more and more, outside of the northeast anyway, an agricultural economy geared towards supplying the British Empire. So Dublin has a lot of thriving businesses, especially if you're looking at food exporters and railways and Guinnesses. But it also has a tremendous amount of poverty. I mean, really horrific poverty. It was the fifth worst city in the world for infant mortality at the start of the century. And it had a quarter of the population living in with more than four people in one room. So the family is in basically a tenement, and they're all stuck together in one room. And so you've got figures that are doing quite well and prospering, but you've got a very impoverished working class. And the other thing which doesn't obviously come into the lockout, but it certainly comes into the rise of national politics, you know, with the formation of the GAA and the Gaelic League, is you have a prosperous middle class, which is spreading into the South Dublin and making their mark there. And that's, you know, to do with long-term changes since the famine. Basically, a rich farming class has got hold of the land. That and some of the land reform has allowed a very strong farming class to emerge in Ireland. These are Catholics, and so they're beginning to change the Irish political scene. But they're rather conservative. So the number of priests per head drops from something like 1 per 2,000 before the famine to 1 to 200 by the turn of the century. There's a lot of more Catholic doctors, Catholic lawyers. And these are providing the basis for a revival of Catholic nationalism of a certain type, the Irish Parliamentary Party type.
In 1908, the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, the ITGWU, was founded. How significant was that in the political landscape of Ireland at the time?
It was of international significance. I think we have to locate what's happening here in a much wider context, that unskilled workers around the world, Western world especially, had discovered that they could, in fact, organise, despite all the difficulties of being sacked if you attempt to organise a union, and of you know, the foreman down at the docks being able to pick and choose who works every day. Despite these kind of difficulties, there's a real sense that the unskilled could organise, and it's a wave of industrial unrest which we tend to encompass under the term syndicalism, and it's basically the belief that if workers stick together, no matter what job, you know, you don't have to be with the same employer, if there's a dispute, you don't scab on it, you don't undermine it, you don't handle these tainted goods. If workers can stick together, even the unskilled can score major victories. So you see strikes of tens of thousands of unskilled workers in this period. In Ireland, it takes one of the most revolutionary forms because of James Larkin. And as you say, he founds the transport union. Big dispute. It was in 1907 when he went to Belfast to organise the National Union of Dock Labourers. And he applied the sympathetic strike tactic and the idea of boycotting tainted goods. And he applied it to set an important precedent of having Protestant and Catholic workers stand by each other and refuse to be divided. And he won a reasonable amount of gains for the particularly the dock workers. But his own union were very unhappy with his radical methods and with riots and with appeals for the police to mutiny. So they sacked him in the end after a certain amount of to and froing. But Larkin really was committed to this new tactic. He could see the potential of it. And so he founds the Irish Transport and General Workers Union in 1908.
And tyranny trampled them in Dublin's gutter until Jim Larkin came along and cried the call of freedom and the call of pride, and slavery crept to its hands and knees, and 1913 cheered from out the utter degradation of their miseries. Jim Larkin, Countess Markovich once said, was like no other I'd come across before. He was a great primeval force rather than a man. Born on January 21st, 1876, in the port city of Liverpool to Irish immigrants, young Larkin was sent to Newry age 5 to live with his grandparents. Just before the age of 10, he was back in the city of his birth, working as a dock labourer. Sacked for going on strike with his men, his union, the National Union of Dock Labourers, sent him to Belfast. It was 1907, and the world was about to be introduced to Jim Larkin. A believer in new unionism, that meant the organisation of all workers rather than just skilled ones, Larkin's habit of rousing workers to shake off their chains led to his expulsion from the NUDL, pushing him into forming the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. Along with James Connolly, he was also instrumental in establishing the Irish Labour Party in 1912. Calling for an 8-hour day, adult suffrage, nationalisation of all means of transport and a pension for all workers over 60, the ITGWU wasn't just a union in the old guild sense of the world, but rather a political force that had set itself on a collision course with capitalism. Those two forces would play out their battle on the streets of Dublin and in the city's slums during 1913 into 14. Larkin would miss the post-1913 revolutionary upheavals in Ireland, having left to raise funds for the ITGWU in America in September of 1914. While Ireland burnt, Larkin, a giant of a man at over 6 foot, was caged in Sing Sing Prison, New York. A red scare which swept the US following the Russian Revolution, catching Larkin in its swell. Whilst in Sing Sing, he would be visited by, amongst others, Charlie Chaplin, while he also wrote letters expressing his support for the anti-treaty faction of the IRA. Larkin died in Dublin in the winter of 1947. Buried in Glasnevin, his headstone simply states, James Larkin, the Labour leader.
Can you tell us a bit about the events which led up to the lockout itself?
Well, I mean, so you've got a rash of successful strikes. You've got workers now on trams and buses, as well as in the docks, wearing the little badge of the union. You've got a real sense of confidence amongst workers, and they're standing up to the employers. And the employers don't like this. They're having to concede, you know, financially. They're having to make bigger payments to the workers. And they begin to... firstly amongst themselves, argue that this Larkinism it has to be stopped, it has to be snuffed out, it needs to be knocked on the head before the whole business ethos of the country is going to be sabotaged in their eyes. And the rallying figure is, of course, William Martin Murphy, and he's the Margaret Thatcher of his day, because the more timid employers, and especially the smaller ones, did not think they could risk taking on the union. And Murphy, on the other hand, thought that they could win and that they had to win. And he also, I mean, this is the man then who owns the tram company, so a very big company. But he also owns the newspapers, the independent newspapers, and a few other businesses. I think one of the hotels on Sackville Street. So he's really, really prominent figure. But he's interesting politically because he's not, he's a supporter of the Irish Parliamentary Party. So, in other words, even though he's an employer who, as we're going to see in the course of the lockout, is going to rely entirely on the British state apparatus to defend him against the Irish working class, he does want home rule for Ireland. He thinks his business will do better under home rule circumstances. And so he puts up a statement to all of his workers, insisting that they sign it as a condition of their employment. And it says that they will not join a union, and specifically they will not join the Irish Transport General Workers Union, and they will leave that union if they are members. So naturally enough, the workers who are presented with this refuse to sign it. And so we get the kickoff of the lockout. It begins when 15th of August, and 4 of these workers who haven't signed his statement are suspended, dismissed in fact. And then it escalates very, very quickly.
William Martin Murphy and his Dublin millionaires tried bribery, corruption, hypocrisy and prayers to break the transport union. Their scabs didn't list, but all their graft was shattered by a scarlet iron fist. So wrote Dominic Behan in his song Connolly Was There. William Martin Murphy in many ways has become a comic villain of Irish history, presented as a thorn in the side of the labour movement, and remembered perhaps mostly for the manner in which the Irish Independent newspaper called for the execution of James Connolly in 1916. Yet Murphy was an incredibly complex character, much more complex than most have allowed him to be when discussing the lockout. One of the principal mistakes in how the lockout is generally discussed in Ireland is the manner in which it can be diminished to a dress rehearsal for the Easter Rising of 3 years later. In reality, 1913 and 1916 are very different, but both very important events. In Murphy, one of the real contradictions of the myth of 1913 is found. If the event is presented as merely a chapter in a battle between Irish nationalism and loyalism, you overlook the crucially important fact that Murphy himself was an Irish nationalist. Indeed, he was even a former member of Parliament for the Irish Parliamentary Party. Murphy was born in the year the famine began, 1845. He hailed from County Cork, but was educated at Belvedere College in Dublin. In his younger years, he worked at the offices of the Irish Builder and the Nation newspapers, which began his lifetime involvement in print media. Murphy's financial empire was built not on print, however, but rather in building light railways in the south and west of the country. He was central to the running of these railways, and his success allowed him to purchase a magnificent Dublin home for himself in 1875. Dartry Hall in Upper Rat Mines is even depicted in Labour cartoons during the lockout. An Irish nationalist, Murphy was elected MP for St Patrick's Division in Dublin in 1885, holding the seat until 1892, but losing at the time of the split in the party to William Field, the Parnellite candidate. Ironically, Murphy would later purchase the Parnellite newspaper, The Daily Independent, which he turned around and completely reinvented, giving birth to the successful Irish Independent still on our shelves today. His business empire was vast. The Independent, the Evening Herald, the Irish Catholic, Cleary's Department Store, the Imperial Hotel, and the Dublin United Tramway Company were all under his control. It was his ownership and control of the trams which brought him into a collision course with the socialist scouser Jim Larkin. Murphy was instrumental in organising the hugely successful International Exhibition in 1907. This event occurred in Herbert Park, and in many ways it brought the world to Dublin. Exhibitions ranged from a live Somali village to food stalls from across Europe and beyond. For his efforts, the Queen wished to knight William Martin Murphy, but Murphy refused such an honour while Home Rule was denied to Ireland, which clearly showed his nationalist politics. While Larkin remains a giant in Dublin folklore and popular memory, Murphy has almost passed into obscurity. His son, William Lombard Murphy, remained central to print media in Dublin and was also central to establishing the Belvedere Newsboys Club, which aimed to assist young Dublin newsboys, many of whom worked for the Evening Herald and the Independent. Ironically, Jim Larkin had organised these very same newsboys prior to the lockout. Independent House on Middle Abbey Street is no longer used by the Irish Independent, but it remains in many ways a monument to the Murphy Empire.
Was there a distinction made at the time between the more aggressive wing of the union movement, or Larkinism, and the side which was more willing to accommodate the employers?
Yeah, that's a good observation. And, you know, I think while some employers are intolerant of any union, and we can see that even today with Boots's resistance right now to allowing an independent union to form, most employers were willing to come to terms with the craft unions anyway. And so, yeah, there's a Dublin Trades Council, which has got a long history and has essentially got its roots in these very stable craft skilled workers organisations. But they are quite relatively conservative, you know, they're very sectional approach to disputes. But that's fine if you're a skilled worker. You know, just 20 skilled workers who've got a very particular skill can make their case, can advance their position. But if you're one of these tram workers, dock labourers or whatever, carters, people who follow the carts and clean the manure up, if you're in any of these casual jobs where anybody could be picked on a particular day to do it, that kind of approach isn't going to work. And so there is a more militant approach, which is one out, all out. And Larkin himself is a revolutionary. He is a revolutionary, and he didn't make any bones about it. His aspiration was not only to win better wages and conditions, but ultimately to have workers take over the running of society through their unions. That's the classic sort of syndicalist idea, that the unions get stronger and stronger, stronger, and then they expropriate the managers and take over. And it's quite contemporary. I mean, there's just right now as we speak, there's two big factory occupations, but it's very interesting to see what they're going to do. In Egypt and in Greece, there's two major factories now being run under workers' control because the managers basically gave up, fled. So anyway, the syndicalist idea is you can extend this kind of thing. Why? And it's being agitated for around the world, and Larkin's very much tuned into the literature that's circulating in the Wobblies in America and in the UK especially, and in their syndicalist newspapers, including one called The Syndicalist, which he has an input to. And workers are all for that at the time, or at least he's selling his paper, is the Irish Worker, and is selling, I think it's upselling something like up to 20,000 at its peak per issue. And we've got to compare this, say, to 2,000 for Arthur Griffiths' Sinn Féin to get some idea of the proportions of influence at this moment. So this particular moment, there is a section of the working class who are all for Larkin's revolutionary ideas. And the employers are probably right to hope that they can split this section off from the more moderate workers' organisations.
One aspect of Larkin's radicalism, when we're talking about August 1913, was seen on the 31st. The union leadership had decided to abide by a police order, not to protest in the city centre, and marched instead to Fairview. Larkin opposed this and went in disguise to the Imperial Hotel on Sackville Street, or what later became O'Connell Street, to speak to the assembled crowds. Can you talk a little bit about how important that day was in the lockout?
Yeah, I think it's a good moment to focus on. Very sort of like a flash of lightning that kind of illuminates an awful lot. It's never been forgotten that he did this. And Larkin had tremendous loyalty. Even years later, when he's put in an American jail, there was a strike on his behalf. You know, you can't imagine a trade union leader today being willing to go to jail in the course of the struggle. But you never know what might happen there. But, Larkin was prepared to go to jail. He was prepared to put his neck on the line. And that won him the loyalty, a long-lasting loyalty, of a section of the working class, especially the dockers. So the other thing that the Bloody Sunday, as it became known, illuminates is just how apt the comparison with Murphy and Thatcher is, because Murphy worked with the British authorities to gain control of the streets and to smash physically get control of the streets, and using large number of police, and to try and demoralise the strike through intimidation and repression. And like you say, some of the images from that day are iconic. I mean, the Russian Revolution, we have the Bloody Sunday, and for their Bloody Sunday, which was far worse in terms of lost, but still massively traumatic here for people to be chased and battered off the streets by the police. And we have those images that have, shaped our consciousness about that day and that evening, because the police then raided the tenements looking for activists and killed two people. So the willingness to use repression, I suppose, is the analogy. And and as I was mentioning earlier, it's kind of interesting that when the class struggle rises, then the more conservative nationalist retreats into the arms of the British authorities for protection, and because they lack their own state, they have no other defence, and they're thrown back into a conservative national role as well as a conservative social role.
Once it had begun, how fast did the lockout spread?
In general, it spreads quite quickly, because there's some 300 employers have been rallied around Murphy, and they're all ready for this moment. So when it happens, they grasp the nettle and they start putting the same statement in front of their workers, and then sacking them. And although some of the employers are rather timid about this, they're kept in line by the bigger ones. So you do have quickly 40,000 people having no income. And so the task, it's an amazing thing that the lockout could last so long, because they've got nothing. And the task of the organisers from the worker side is to make sure nobody starves, and basically that people have the wherewithal to defy and refuse to work for them until they're allowed to be in their union.
Why is the 1913 lockout relevant for today? What pictures did it paint of society then? How similar is it to society today? Working class people in institutions find ourselves being squeezed once again. These same patterns keep re-emerging, which begs the question, why did workers and urban communities feel the need to organize and resist in the first place? It is time for a closer look at Ireland's history, to examine the likes of Big Jim Larkin and James Connolly. What advice would they give us today? Their lessons and those of the workers of 1913 suggest that what rights we do have were reluctantly conceded by the powerful, the people who fought back and organised against attacks from above. Is this the mindset of today's unions and the working people who are their members? And other questions are posed. Who are the powerful of 2013? Who are those that lock out working class people from having their needs met and a certain quality of life fulfilled? Who are the modern William Martin Murphys? Are the majority of the people as disenfranchised today as they were 100 years ago? Hidden in plain sight, our day-to-day life can reveal some clues. The Transport Union of 1913, which Larkin established, brought the tram workers out on strike. Today, Bus Éireann and recently the Lewis workers are fighting for similar reasons as those transport workers did in 1913. This podcast series will examine what we can learn for today from the events of the 1913 lockout. To what degree are the same battles and stories going on in society today? Who is winning them? Who is telling them? Do the hopes and aims of working class people for a better society remain unfulfilled a century later? Do we have unfinished business?
That's all for this week. Thanks for listening. If you would like to contribute or get in touch, email us at ub13@gmail.com. Contributors for this week's episode were Ronan Burtonshaw, Donald Fallon, Kevin Brannigan, Shane Fitzgerald and Owen Griffin. Thanks to Connor Costick. Produced by Tom McDermott and Barra Hamilton.